2020 is pulling everyone's mask off. I mean, whether it's Democrats and their murder of the Me Too movement and their blind support for someone like Joe Biden.
They seemed really unreasonable, and it's like, are we still playing this game? What do you guys think about that?
In the here and now, that is going to be my concern. We don't want to see any more loss of life just because he wants to own the world.
And then have these politicians who want to co-opt everything just because it's near election time.
But solutions for these problems have to be positive, and they can't be based in policing. They just can't be based in more authoritarianism. They can't be, they don't arrest your way out of these problems.
Good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night at 8 p.m. here in New Jersey. It's time for NJRR Live. My name is Brian Powers. I'm your host for the evening. I want to thank everybody who supports us, and that includes our sponsors like the August Agency, the Coffee House in New Jersey, Blissful Infusions. Together with them, we're putting together a special episode of NJR Live this Saturday featuring Dr. Leticia Sampson. I'm really excited to talk about mental health and activism, something that impacts, I think, everybody at this point. Because of capitalism, everybody's mentally ill. That's the way I look at it. But I think activists and those of us that, put ourselves at the front of these causes, whether it be struggles against police brutality or whether we feed homeless in community feeding programs or whatever, put specific stresses on ourselves and on the people around us. And in our organizations, it can be very difficult to manage stress. And I notice, of course, that stress levels go up around election time a lot. And there's all, and you don't even have to be involved in electoral politics to feel the stress of a nation, trying to pick a leader of a gigantic fucking mess. I did work for the Howie Hawkins campaign for a couple of months there as a national organizer, and recently warned people on Facebook. And I know some people are tuning in and want me to expand upon this as far as like not just vague booking a post that says, that's a unhealthy environment. But the bottom line is the way I was removed from that campaign, one was bizarre. And it was reminiscent of what happened to me at CWA, to be honest with you. Those of you that follow my story know I was fired by a major labor union. They went through great lengths and paid lawyers and doctors, covered up documents. And, ultimately, even though I was found fired without just cause, I wasn't allowed to return to work. So it was a bizarre situation that sucked up a lot of my life. And I'll be honest with you. And I read this recent NLRB ruling where they've pulled back on something that was very important to union labor. And it was the idea that when you went into a grievance meeting where you advocated for somebody as a union rep, that you're on level playing field with management. And I was always taught this, that when you sit at a table with somebody, it doesn't matter if that's a CEO of the company and you dig a ditch. When you sit at a table as a union rep, that guy's your equal, and you need to be able to deal with him as your equal in order to get, the respect at the table that you need. And that means at times you may tell this guy to go fuck himself, or you may say you're an asshole, or this policy is fucking stupid, or your supervisor is a moron. Things like this come out of the table all the time. And what management, I've noticed, there's trends in management labor relations. And one of the techniques they like to do is they like to gaslight you. They like to poke at you, make fun of you, play stupid as if they don't know the answer to the question until you finally blow up, call them an asshole. And now, boom, you're the bad guy. Well, they've now legislated this into existence. We're always protected about this language. And I want people to think about, when I think about my own personal struggles and what I went through, I want people to think about all these unions that cry about this case. And I saw this posted on by Labor Notes, something that the Communications Workers of America, CWA, sponsors. So, the unions cry about this stuff, and they say we're eroding our rights, and these things are eroding our rights. And basically the idea that a guy can now get in trouble, or anybody can get in trouble. I shouldn't use those gender terms. I apologize. But you know, when somebody can get in trouble for advocating for you just for cursing, you've put serious, serious handcuffs on that person and given management a gigantic upper hand. And basically you're just sitting at that table as a pawn and a slave again, rather than somebody who's representing people as a union member. And so the unions will cry foul. And I found this wrong, and people are already saying this takes away a lot of rights. But in my case, the Communications Workers of America argued for that. And they argued that because a person badmouthed their boss, that they couldn't be returned to work. When it worked out for union leadership, they took away union rights from me and from everybody. My Facebook posts were used against me. My Facebook posts spoke out against a narcissistic boss who fired me without just cause. And union labor that's supposed to protect rights like that actually came after my rights. And if my case had been used in that NLRB case, it would have been used on the side of management. Because unions don't give a fuck about workers anymore. It's sad to say, but I saw it from the inside. I worked in Trenton for 4 or 5 years, and it was disgusting. The conversations I had were never about the best, the welfare of the members. It was always about the welfare of politicians. And that's why I never got really involved with the Democratic Party, because you're disgusting people that will sell out anybody for anything at any given time. The smallest favor will result in budgets getting slashed for homeless people. It doesn't matter. I've seen it, and I've seen unions sell out just about everybody they're supposed to be advocating for. And so I got more and more disgusted. And in the end, now that I don't work for unions anymore, I feel more free. I have an independent media company that I work with. I have way more comrades that I trust and love and that I feel support me back. And so I'm in a better environment. In the end, it worked out. It's good for me. But it's disgusting to me seeing that kind of stuff. And then I get involved with the Howie Hawkins campaign, who claims to be better on labor. Who claims to be this big labor advocate, wears a fucking Teamster jacket as if he was ever a shop steward. He was never a shop steward. Never served his union, as far as I know. He likes to wear a jacket as if he did. But he clearly doesn't understand how to respect labor. Because when you do respect labor, Mr. Hawkins, you pay them more than $500 a month for full-time work. You don't classify them as contractors when they're doing essential services. And you give them just cause when you terminate them, regardless of their status as an employee. I got none of that. And I filed complaints against you, Mr. Hawkins, 60 fucking days ago, and you didn't respond. I waited for your pathetic ass campaign to get back to me. All I really wanted was a decent exit interview, and I couldn't get it. Howie Hawkins doesn't respect labor any more than any Democrat I've ever met. And I'm ashamed that he's our party's candidate right now. And I'm disgusted with the New Jersey State Party that absolutely refused to support me politically. They tried to keep me quiet. I tried to do this internally for 2 friggin' months, and now I got to get on an independent media station and beat up a party that I loved, a party that I worked for 6 years to organize for, with all my comrades, some of whom I went to fucking jail with, turn their back on me because of Howie fucking Hawkins. It ain't worth it. And if that's the way you're going to treat activists, if that's going to you're going to treat your friends in the media, how many times I put you on my media network? How many fucking times? I introduced your pathetic campaign manager to leaders in the Socialist Party, and I helped build left unity. I was never able to argue for my job back because Howie Hawkins was too fucking busy kissing ass and trying to run a smear campaign through his network. He can eat me. And I wouldn't get involved with Howie Hawkins' campaign unless it was for the benefit of my comrades in the local area. And I know there's people out there working for ballot access, and we're going to have some Howie Hawkins people on, people that support and work on his campaign. I don't give a fuck. You want to work for this guy, fine. You want to support him, fine. I may even still vote for him, to be honest with you, just so the Greens get more votes and maybe we get closer to that. I still want to make a statement. This isn't a personal thing like go vote for Joe Biden. Fuck Joe Biden. Doesn't make Joe Biden a good person because Howie Hawkins is a dipshit. But he's a dipshit. And I feel badly that I supported him. And the only reason I had to come out is because I told everybody on a national stage, because of the Howie Hawkins campaign, that we were going to run a campaign that cares about each other and supports each other, because these environments are stressful and they're difficult to deal with. And we need to be there for each other. And 4 days later, I was fired by email and not allowed to plead my case against just cause. I lied to an entire country, and the Howie Hawkins campaign is not going to attach my name to that nonsense. If you don't know how to care for activists, you shouldn't be running an activist network. And that's the end of that. And I'm done with that. I've got activist stuff going on all over me, and I don't need the Howie Hawkins campaign. All right. So I'm going to bring in just one of those people, just one of those amazing people that have been with me long before the fucking campaign and will be here with me long after, because we got shit to do. My comrade, Walt. How you doing, sister?
Hello. How are you, Brian? I just want to say, like, you know, I support you, support the work that you've done. And I feel if a party wants to show themselves as being different than the Democrats, you don't run a rubbing alcohol version of the champagne party. why would I want that? Practice what you preach, and then people will you know, that's, you know, it's sad. Practice what you preach. That's all I'm going to say on that matter. People know how I feel, but you know, that's, you know, and all the things that you said, I ditto. That's all I'm going to say. Ditto, ditto, ditto. So everybody wanna know, like, oh, this is just a Brian thing. Actually, no, we've all talked about this, and ditto. And so, I mean, like, you know, with that, let's kind of segue, because we're all about talking a bit about
eugenics. I don't know how to fucking segue to your thing.
Segue. We're talking about, well, you know, eugenics, okay? Well, we're going to talk about eugenics. And,
very smooth.
Yes. And our whistleblower, Dawn Wooten, who was a nurse. And actually, this actually has a little bit to do with labor. She was a nurse. She's a full-time nurse in Atlanta at the Irwin detention center, where immigrants are unjustly detained because this country is a white supremacist country. And so we have white supremacist policies in regards to immigration. So we lock people up. We lock children. We lock mothers. We lock fathers. We lock people up. Now, I want to say, like, you don't have to be a child. You don't have to be, because also this always, so this thing is kind of like, if you're a person of color, or if you're Black or Latinx or all this, if you don't, are not a child, no one cares about you. And that's totally not okay. This is all part of eugenics. From eugenics was actually founded, or the term was made up. The actual, not term, but the actual idea is just a made up concept by Francis Galton. We probably heard it through Charles Darwin in 1883. And essentially what it is to control people who are not white so that you can have a master white race. How does this connect to what's going on today? We have a doctor who was just willy-nilly giving people hysterectomies. So eugenics is also as part of the detention center, locking people up and kind of going, we want to make sure that we have the right kind of people who will work for the right kind of people that we can exploit. Then it's going to control their people's bodies, saying, okay, you can't have children. So we're going to willy-nilly, and people who are like saying, well, maybe they need a hysterectomy. Well, you know, people don't just give mass hysterectomies. Well, why would you need to have hysterectomy if you're in such a bad position where you need a hysterectomy in a detention center? They should let you out. They should let you out. If your condition is so extreme that you need a hysterectomy, they should let you out of detention. So it's bullshit, because what happens is they're also getting funding for this crap. They're getting funding because you get funding when you sterilize Black women, when you sterilize a Latinx woman, when you sterilize Chicanos. We have a long history of doing that in our country. In 1907, we started a eugenics board where we sterilized people. And also, let's swing this back to COVID-19. If COVID-19's death rates for white people were the same as they were for Chicano people, for Latinx people, for Boricans, for Southeast Asians, for Black people, we have 2 to 3, at some point 5 times the death rates and actually catching COVID than white people. If white people were dying at the rate of Chicanos in regards to COVID-19, this country would be closed down. So all of this, from the detention, from the hysterectomies, from how we're handling COVID, is from a eugenics white supremacist perspective. And it's so disturbing, because people, if you don't know history, you don't really understand what's going on. You don't really understand how this is all connected. People think it's like, oh, it's just random. I'm like, no, this actually isn't random. And that's why I'm like, you know, to me, you know, what is going on in regards to controlling this kind of manner, this kind of stuff, we need someone who's, like I said, this needs to be done. This needs to be done, because people kind of go, well, it's kind of the same, you know, all the same kind of stuff that's been happening. And I'm actually like, This is actually a little worse. A little bit worse than what's been happening.
Thanks for popping in late here, because just so people know, I kind of came at Lark a little bit late last night. I was like, hey, you want to co-host tomorrow? I kind of forgot to get co-host. My bad. I set up this awesome show. I forgot to get co-host. So thanks for jumping in late. And I said, you know, I collaborated. I said, what do you want to talk about? She said, eugenics. I was like, oh, okay. It's something I usually maybe would prep a little bit more for, but I did take an opportunity to read the Wikipedia page at least. And what I was struck by was you talked about, like, this isn't a freak weird cult thing. This has been ingrained in establishments going back to Plato. I started reading a little bit about the history in the Wikipedia page, of course. And it talked about Plato talking about Romans. There was a law that had Romans required the fathers to kill deformed babies. And this is before Darwin and before that.
I want to bring up another point in regards to the eugenics in the United States and white supremacy. The guy who's founded it, Francis Galton, he wrote in 1873, he wrote this letter called Africa for the Chinese. As you know, England went all over the world, actually just, you know, colonizing everybody. And so what they essentially said was that Chinese people should replace Africans in Africa, since Chinese people were smarter than Africans. So while I understand what you're saying in regards to what you were referring to, the thing is that this is kind of how racists get out of the conversation. They're like, oh, it's always existed. But no, in the United States, it's directly tied to this dude. Directly tied to, and also I'll tell you something else that's also tied to this, standardized testing. All of this is directly tied together. This guy and Darwin, they actually gave legitimacy and gave peer-reviewed research for racism in this country. They literally just used this scientist dude and his book, Darwin, and this guy was a cousin.
The term keep being used over and over again is scientific racism.
While
it's used to justify the existence of this as something that's been around, what it is it's always been used to justify racism and genocides, and where it really came into modern times, I think, and what you're talking about, like leading up to, of course, the Holocaust, and that was the largest, the sentence that struck me in my reading was when the Nuremberg trials started to take place, the defense of the Nazis was, well, this is what the Americans did. We just modeled our eugenics program after the American genocide of Native American peoples and others who got in their way and who were considered genetically inferior. So all we did was what they did. So why are we getting in trouble for it? That was their defense at the Nuremberg trials, part of it at least. And, you know, so while we, you know, like you said, it's always existed, but it's always existed as an evil entity used for horrible things. And it has existed on a very established level in the United States. You named some big figures. The group that I read about was the American Eugenics Society, which was formed in 1916, 1917, and actually worked with the Catholic Church to form ethical standards around applying eugenics in societies. And Catholic churches, that, of course, said, you know, don't kill Catholics.
Well, you know, the thing is that...
That was their standard of, you know, genetic superiority.
Well, I think another thing people have to understand is that in the United States, being Black is viewed as being Black for the eugenics are viewed as a disability. So when they kind of try to hide, oh, it's people who are disabled, they view being Black as a disability. So this is just like they did this in North Carolina. They did this from the 1930s, 1970s. They sterilized men and women under the eugenics program. In 1937, Law 116 essentially started sterilizing Boricuan, Puerto Rican women. By the 60s, a third of Puerto Rican women had, no, thir- yeah, over a third of Puerto Rican women of childbearing age had been sterilized. They started doing it with the Indian Health Services, with United States Public Health Department. They started in the early 20th century. By the 1970s, a quarter of childbearing women in Native Americans were sterilized. So this is a wide spreading, huge program that not meant to like actually kill off all people of color, but to manage our population so that white people could stay. And of course, there are different variations of white people. But for the white people who were at the top of the food chain, so that they could have people to work for them, but yet not enough people to rise up. So, you know, the white supremacy in the United States has been a very careful monitoring and monitoring the population, but also deciding who can be white, letting certain people into whiteness and kind of like, oh, we're running out of people. We'll let this crew be white. We'll let the Irish be white. We'll let the Italians be white. So it's, you know, eugenics is kind of like this weird, it's like I said, it's not scientific. So you can literally just make up the rules as you go.
It's all based on what are preferred qualities. Well,
yeah.
You know, blonde hair is a preferred quality. Is blonde hair? I mean, like, honestly, like, you just make up what your preferred qualities
are.
Yeah.
And I think that's so funny to me. I'm like, imagine, like, if you're like, you're a rich dude, right? Like, let me imagine, like, you and me talking, right? And like, we have a conversation and I like get drunk and then like, I think of this really cool idea and I'm like, I wake up and I write it down, like a philosophy, I write it down. But because I'm a rich white dude, I can take this to the New York Times and have them publish it. I mean, that's essentially what this dude did. He like had this totally like outrageous concept, but because he was part of the upper classes, he was able to get this concept published in the Times, which is like the oldest, you know, like I guess continuous daily newspaper or paper of record in Western society, your English speaking society. And so I just think, and then that still happens today. You know, I try to think of, you know.
Look at who our Secretary of Education is.
Yeah.
It's some rich dipshit who may be one of the dumbest people in America.
Well, the scariest thing is this.
$1 billion, so she's head of education.
Well, Redfield, the head of the CDC, people are always confused. I'm like, well, the CDC said one thing, and then the CDC said another thing. I'm like, yes, because the head of the CDC is like a major conservative Catholic, and he is a weirdo, and he has bad scientific practices, and he bases everything on the Bible. So the real scientists are doing work, and then Redfield's like, oh, I think, like, you know, someone gives him enough money or talks to him or reaches out to him, and all of a sudden, you know, a whole, like, oh, don't wear masks. Oh, wear masks. Don't wear masks. Don't wear masks. I'm like, oh, my God. It's like I said, this is, you know, for me, I'm just like, this whole administration needs to go. Like, I don't, like, I get everybody's, like, you know, the whole machine is whatever. I'm like, but are you willing to die tomorrow? Because, I mean, that's, we're actually getting to that. Like, or do you want to die tomorrow? Because I don't.
Yeah. I mean, we should touch on a little bit of the COVID stuff, I think. Did you see this guy from the CDC that made statements regarding upcoming elections and that if Trump is defrauded out of the elections, that people should get their guns? This guy works at the CDC. He's got no training in medical anything. He's just like a donor or a Trump supporter. And now he's saying he's going to take medical leave, and he's been under a lot of stress at work. But he accused he accused scientists at the CDC of sedition.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is that, you know what? All you got to do is say it. As you know, as a person who has been smeared yourself, and as I have been a person, you could be like, oh, just kidding. Like, you don't have to, as long as you put it out in the air, it's like the American, okay, I don't want to be insulting, but the US, the public is like this. They're like whoever tells the teacher first, that's who you believe. That's what the teacher believes. And that's the US public. And you could even be like, you know what? I was told a lie, but it doesn't matter. Once it's out there, because the thing is that, you know,
nobody pays attention to the response.
Exactly. Nobody, you can't like take it back. There's no take backs.
if I say that Martians just landed in my toilet bowl, they will run with that headline 4 days later, print something 8 pages back that say that didn't really happen. Brian just got smoked some really good weed.
Yeah. Like, oops.
It really would be like, and nobody would know. And years later, everybody would just remember that Martians landed in my toilet bowl. Nobody would ever think that it was just me being stupid.
Yeah.
Now the media works.
No. But I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, just, you know, I like to think about, you know, just like going to be upfront. Like, I'm a fan of Bob Woodward. And people are like, well, he should have told immediately. And I'm like, journalists, we're under no obligation to give the police information. And this is the same Justice Department that's actually defending Trump on rape charges. And you guys all have like the brains of fish because the Republicans have already said, put forth a law, the Safe to Work Act, which said, and this is like in July, that said retroactive to 2019, you cannot sue your employer if they get you, if their negligence causes you to get sick. And guess what? If you sue them, they can sue your family because you'll probably be dead. They can sue your family for a frivolous lawsuit. I mean, this is the Justice Department we're supposed to go to. I mean, I'm just like, we can't even do journalism anymore. How do you do investigative reporting if every time you get any information, you're like, well, I got to go and tell this little piece of information to the public? We already knew everything. The public already, everybody already freaking told you in January, in February, in March. You decided you want to listen. And now you were like, oh, and now Trump gets on, Trump gets on the air and literally says, oh, it's Bob's fault. He should have said something. And everybody's like, well, yeah, it is Bob's fault. I'm like, I can't freaking believe this. Are you out of your damn minds? I can't.
You know, look, everybody, by all accounts, we're going to have a vaccine soon. And what the really important thing, I'm going to go right back to the beginning of what you said. Let's not just imagine me and you getting drunk together. Let's just get a vaccine so me and you can actually get drunk together. We have to talk about our sponsors, and then we're going to get on to some music and some activism, which I'm looking forward to. But I want to thanks, Lark, of course, for bringing the conversation. It's something I hadn't studied up on. I didn't know there was still this much activity around eugenics and stuff like that. So I appreciate you bringing
it. I literally
to the
told
show.
You like 20 minutes before.
Can I write a whole Wikipedia page, right? So look at me, the journalist. All right. So sponsoring coming up for this Saturday. So this is our last regular show of NJR Live this month. I'm going to take off. I got some stuff to do. We're retooling. Like I said, you might have saw the new intro. I said, when things are going to change around here, they're going to change for the better, but I got to take some time off to make that happen. So this Saturday, I'm going to send you off as I take vacation until October with a very special mental health and activism featuring Dr. Letitia Sampson from Great Joy Counseling. We've got sponsors from the Coffee House in Edison, which you may have visited and saw New Jersey Revolution Radio live in. But, you know, of course, since the disaster, we haven't done anything out in public. We'll be back. We'll be back. Don't worry. And also Blissful Infusion CBD chocolates and all kinds of edible infusions. So check them out on Facebook if you're interested in that. So I want to thank everybody that participated. I talked about at the beginning of the show. And look, you know, one of the things I've learned by being open about mental health issues, you kind of think like you'll inspire people and it will help people understand that mental health is something we all deal with. Every single person on the face of the earth has to deal with mental health and mental health issues. Even if you don't have severe ones yourself, you probably know people in your family and friends that have dealt with, you know, mental health. So it's important for all of us, but specifically in the activist community, I think we need to talk more about it openly and prepare our organizations, you know, have places that are safe and positive for people undergoing crisis so they don't wind up getting, you know, having their lives ruined or having their activism ruined over just having some problems along the way, because we all have problems along the way. I'm looking forward to the conversation. You can tune in this weekend. The Facebook event is on there. You can set your reminders. It'll be on YouTube. It'll be on Twitter. It'll be on Facebook Live 10 a.m. this Saturday again, and support our sponsors. We still have sponsorships open. If you want to throw a few dollars, I will read your name, just like I'm reading the names of the Coffee House on Amboy Ave in Edison, New Jersey, and Blissful Infusions one more time. And if you're watching, you see a little ticker on the bottom and it tells you the name of our sponsor. So I'll even give you a little ticker line where you can put your website, your phone number, you know, a comment, say hi to your mom, happy birthday to somebody, whatever. Give us a call. We'll put you on there. I'm going to bring in Money Mostafi. Mostafi is how you pronounce the last name, right?
Can I hear you?
Yeah, you have to unmute before you tell us if I'm pronouncing your name wrong.
Okay, unmute. Here we go. That's it.
Money Mostafi. Pronounced money, but it's spelled M-A-N-I for those of you on the podcast that can't see them. Is with a band called Race Trader. I'm going to play you a quick second of their music. This is anti-racist death metal. I saw these guys live probably about 2 years ago in Brooklyn, and I was hooked immediately. I just loved their music. I had no idea what he was saying until I went home and read the lyrics. But, I mean, I love this music to begin with. So I fell in love with his music, and then I found out they had great politics. So let's listen to a second of... Lark.
Yes.
That's your kind of music. Is that your kind of music? Have you listened to death metal before?
I have listened to death metal before, but I'll tell you, my ex. Anyway, he was the magazine Angry Thrower, and I don't know if you know it, but he covered hardcore and death metal, and it was based in Los Angeles. I don't know if you guys know. Okay.
No.
This is something he would very much like.
Great. I mean, this whole compilation, Shut It Down, Benefit for the Movement for Black Lives. It's something you put together, right, Monty? Money.
Yeah. It's something right after the uprising in Minneapolis started, it was kind of like one of those moments where I think everybody checked in with themselves and said, what am I doing? How am I using my platforms? And I just got on the phone with some friends right away and said, you know, at least we could raise some money. You got any songs? Let's put out a comp. And they turned into Shut It Down.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite song on there out of all the bands?
Oh, there's a lot of really, really good songs. There's a song by a San Antonio Chicano band called Amygdala that seems to be really great. There's a band from Philly called Konashi who's got a song about actually like black representation in punk and metal media. And that song, they put a shout out to me in it. Mm-hmm. And it's already an amazing song, and then it talks about me, so I can't not love that one. And and there's a band called Thou on there that did a beautiful cover of a Bad Religion song. So there's a lot of beautiful songs on there. Yeah. There's a band called the 1865 who did a great cover of a classic DC hardcore band called Minor Threat. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of songs on there I really like.
Cool, man. All right. And we're also going to add to our panel Jeremy Ritt, who you may know as Infinite Skills. And you may have heard that name because this dude has been done some pretty big stuff. He wrote songs for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. He performed in some pretty big crowds, man. Looking at your bio is pretty cool. Jeremy, welcome to the program. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for having me.
Cool. I know that you've performed in front of tens of thousands, but this has got to be the highlight of your career.
Of course. I mean, I get to go with a real life celebrity, Brian Powers, and meet some new friends too. So
yeah. We're a high end production. Did you see my background fall down while Lark was talking?
I did not. I was looking down and trying to find my light here so I could get my light on because you know, brother's kind of darkly complected. So if I don't have good lighting, then you can't see how pretty I am.
I'm shiny as hell, and I ran out of makeup like 2 weeks ago, but it just doesn't seem like a priority. So, you know, it's being shiny is not, you know, we all have struggle. What can I say? Yeah.
You look good.
Jeremy's latest work right now is a tribute to the Green Party's 10 Key Values. What's the name of this song, brother?
It is the 10 Green Commandments. It's a play on Biggie Smalls' 10 Crack Commandments. Obviously, I was not a crack dealer, but I am all about grassroots democracy, so I made it my own.
Let's check this out.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
It's the 10 Green Commandments. Yep. Yeah. I'm Infinite Skills. Let's go. I've been with the Greens for years. It made me less animal. There's rules to the switch. They gave me a manual. The 10 key values needed for you to get democracy on track. Not your rights pushed back. Let's go. Rule number uno. You should already know grassroots democracy is the only way to go. For sure. The very bleed power leads to misdeeds. So to fight that plight, we must all unite. Number two, social justice and equal opportunity. fair treatment under the law for all communities, indubitably. Great. Society flies highest when we remove all bias. We should definitely try it. Number three is probably what you knew about Greens. Ecological wisdom is how we came on the scene. We are all one team.
Facts.
People and the planet can't live without nature, so don't take it for granted. Number four, nonviolence, heard this before. If you live by the sword, then you die by the sword. Number five, power must be decentralized. Resolve it at the local so all of us don't control you. Number six, community-based economics is the culture. Top-down approaches, we can go ahead and roast them. Seven, his value is so underrated. Right. Feminism and gender.
So based on the 10 key values of our political party, the Green Party, we have the 10 Green Commandments. Jeremy, when did that come out? I know you've been telling me about it. It's been out for a while. I know it's first. I heard of it tonight.
So I joined the Greens back in 2016. I'm a Democrat.
Sorry about that.
I left after I saw what they did to Bernie and kind of how the DNC sort of co-opted and took over that and just sort of decided who they were going to have run for the party. So once I left there, I was looking for a home for my leftist politics. I found the Green Party and I was trying to learn about them and figure out what they're all about. I saw the platform, liked the platform, wanted to be able to share that platform with as many people as I possibly could. So I wanted to make a mix of my politics and my music. And it helped me remember how to sort of communicate with people about what the Green Party stands for. Because a lot of people don't know that they even exist still to this day.
And Lark is with the panel, not just because she's my co-host tonight, but because she's a writer. Because I saw recently, you know, she defined herself as a writer. She's many things, but I do. And you've been quite prolific during COVID. Your word count is somewhat unbelievable that I saw on Facebook. Is that
that was from a death in January? I have a 2 million word count from January. So wow. During COVID, I have, I think, 800,000 words during COVID.
How did you determine that? Did you like go back and
well, look? I think that Google Docs is great. So you can kind of like measure how many words that you've been doing. And that's kind of like how I found out how many words I've been writing. But what's that have to do with these two?
Writing is an art. I mean, we
no, do. No, I do view it because the thing is that you know, the hardcore scene, the punk scene, you know, like the Dead Kennedys, stuff like that. I mean, they really inspired me. Like my poetry and like I started off doing poetry and same. Music was kind of part of that. Especially in the 90s, we were all very DIY. We did our own magazines. We had a zine. And so we're all very political. I always say, if you're a part of Generation X, well, we're the tail end of Generation X. Like, the reason why you're so DIY and independent is because there wasn't enough of us for them to give a shit. I mean, I like to say that we are so like, oh, because we're so hardcore. I'm like, they just didn't feel it was worth marketing to us. So it kind of creates this culture. I think that, you know, you two are a testament to that, where you just kind of do your own thing and create your own thing. And we're kind of like, why can't you? And I'm like, well, the thing is that we were ignored, kind of like, you know, the latchkey kid, like, you know what? Go for it. Do whatever you need. We really don't care what you do. Don't care.
You hear a lot about musicians who go into politics or politicians that do music. And I can think of examples from Nirvana. I think that the bassist from Nirvana is now state assemblyman out in Washington State. Sonny Bono comes to mind. You know, there's been a lot of musicians. And I'm kind of a musician that left it behind. I still consider myself a drummer at heart, but I really haven't played in a band or done anything serious in 20 years. But that kind of being on a stage and getting the attention and having people cheer your performance is something that politicians get as well. There's a rush with being on stage. You know, and performing and seeing people cheer, you get it. And it's a very similar feeling to when I've given a good speech in front of a nice sized crowd. Ooh. As when I've, you know, been, remember when I was a kid and when I was in drama and put on a performance during a play, or when I was a drummer and managed to do my fill the right way. You know, I mean, do you think about that money? I mean, I see you nodding your head there. I mean, do you think that the kind of the rush you get from performance translates between politics and art and your music?
I mean, I'm often one of the guys that gets asked to speak at the rallies, and that skill set was honed on the punk stage. So it's there's a very symbiotic relationship between being an artist and a political communicator. I mean, it should also be contextualized that I've always been a political artist. I've never put out anything that wasn't pretty political. So for me, there wasn't ever a clear demarcation between activism and being an artist. It was all the same process, and it just came out with different outputs. Sometimes that output is like a political essay, sometimes that output is a speech or a debate, and sometimes that output is a, you know, a punk song or a death metal song or something like that. So it's all, it's, there's, and then in terms of what you're saying, in terms of like the, I guess the psychological reaction to it, I actually find that the art's much more enjoyable. I mean, the admiration you might get if you're like, an local activist hero is something, but there's something about playing a song and playing it really well that even the audience being there or not there doesn't really matter. It's just personal and cathartic. And for me, that cathartic aspect of it is what kind of allows me to sort of maintain my activism in the world. It allows me an emotional outlet, a way to sort of recharge that's not entirely escapist. But it allows me to sort of have a more human response to things that I'm sometimes, you know, always dealing with in an intellectual movement oriented sort of way. So there's also that aspect too, like being able to talk about the same issues in a creative way allows me to sort of get to the heart of why I'm an activist and allows me not to get as easily burned out. So burnout, I think everybody's been there. It's a natural part of, you know, fighting big institutions. You get knocked down enough that, you know, you want to take a break, and that's fine. The issue is whether you get back up and keep going.
Jeremy. So he talked about like translating skills. I guess. And I mean, do you see translating skills,
Absolutely. But it was fascinating to hear Money talk about how he gets the catharsis, whether or not the crowd is there. My catharsis comes in the creation of the song and creation of the art. And then when I get to the stage, my, energy comes from making that connection with the people that are in front of me. So I absolutely need that crowd in front of me. I need that those people for me to be able to connect with. And that's the translating skill that I see from a politics standpoint is you can't be involved in a movement if you can't connect people to that movement. And so if you can't get people who are of like mind to have to be motivated to do what it takes in order to move that that cause forward, then, you know, that's where movements can die. And just like my positioning as a hip hop artist and what I'm trying to portray with my art, if I can't connect with people on stage, it doesn't matter really. I mean, it matters for my own mental health that I have that outlet and that I can create. And Lark, I started as writing poetry, but without having an ability to make that connection with the people, I feel like I would only be doing half my job as an artist.
Well, I think that for me, I don't know if you're done. I'm just wanting to. For me, like I'm a poet, but like I'm a satirist poet, and so I did satire. And my stuff is about economics, capitalism. I'm making fun of capitalism. I'm kind of like have this gross character that loves money and all these things happen. Kind of like they're just. We call it a cute little book about horrible people or something like that. Anyway. My book of poetry. But the thing is that I found it easier in the arts for me to be political because for me as a black woman, like they only want me to talk about black woman issues. And if anybody reads my writing knows that that's like only a little portion of what I talk about, like I can't talk about economics. I can't talk about policy. They just want me to talk about like, and it always pissed me off, which is why I'm not in politics because I'm like, I'm not going to be your black chick for your little event. It's not happening. So, I mean, I like the fact that when I get to do poetry, and also, too, it's kind of funny because I'll do poetry, and you're like, I didn't know you were going to do poetry like that. I expected it to be more Black. I'm like, what do you mean more Black? It is Black. I'm very Black. I mean, it's like I'm from a Black neighborhood. I grew up as a Black person. What do you mean? But, I mean, I found politics so challenging, and in that, like, actual active politics, I feel like life is political. You can't not be political.
Absolutely.
Even if you're being part of the system or you're fighting against it, like, even in, I've done children's books and stuff like that, but I'm going to talk about myself too much, but I'm just saying, I remember, like, one children's book author, like, why does everything have to be political? I'm like, you are being political. You are, like, indoctrinating children with capitalism and a really narrow view of the world. So you are also political. She got all pissed off, but that's the truth.
where I think of Lark more than anything is in education, but like you said, you have a diverse background, which I love having you on the program, because we can, like, you know, I'm always trying to draw parallels, and that's why I like this music and activism thing. And when I think of educating people, I don't just think in a classroom, right? I think of how I learned as a child from music or art or writing. You know, everybody mentioned they're political. I don't think my music was political growing up. And my politics sucked when I was younger, so I'm glad I wasn't political in my music. But I was always a political person. You know what I'm saying? I was always from high school. I remember leading up to the Iraq War. As a matter of fact, I've been going through my attic and finding old newspapers with articles like Clinton refuses to remove landmines and things like that. And it's a fascinating study when you find old newspapers and you remember back. But you know, the education I got came from music too. I think of Jeremy, and right away when I heard him, even before we talked about his music, I heard Run DMC. I'm like, wow, this guy draws a lot from a band of my past. Probably one of the first rap albums I owned was I think Tougher Than Leather. It was either that or the one after it. But your music really brought back a past to me and brought back, you know, memories associated with my politics at that time. I grew up in a white community. Right. I grew up in an all white community. I didn't know any Black people until I joined the military and I was 18 or 19 year old. And I didn't have any kind of diversity of thought. And so when I think of Public Enemy or Run DMC or, you know, the African-American artists that made their way into my bubble, you know, they impacted me tremendously because I had such a limited experience with people outside of my own community. I don't know what Run DMC means to you and your music, but that's what they meant to me. And I have to ask you specifically about Run DMC's impact, you know, on your musical style, because it's there, you hear it, and I love it. I think it's a great, you know, tribute and carrying on a great tradition.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely listened to Run DMC when I was younger. I listened to KRS-One, I listened to Gangstar, and I've always wanted to try to, I guess if I was, you know, being honest with myself, I would say that I'm sort of, in some ways, a gateway drug for people who don't really understand Black culture, because I have had a lot of experience in, you know, suburbs or whatever, but also living in Black neighborhoods. And so I can speak and operate in both worlds. And I think you kind of have to be able to as a Black person in America. And I definitely agree with what she said, that I'm Black. I grew up Black, and I think whoever you are in America, is if you're a Black person, that's Black. Like, I reject the idea that there's any kind of one type of Black person. So one of the reasons why I wanted to get involved in hip hop was I didn't see a lot of myself in some of the stories that I was hearing. You know, it's a lot of rags to riches or whatever. And thankfully, you know, my parents, you know, my dad was in the Army 20 years. My mom is, you know, professional as well, you know, working for the government. But like, they sort of rose themselves out of poverty and then set the table for us to go from, you know, working class to middle class or whatever. And so I'm proud of the work that they did. And I'm proud of my ability to build upon that work. But I didn't see a lot of those kinds of stories in the hip hop that I grew up listening to. And so I just decided, it was like, well, if no one else is doing it, why not me? And so that's kind of the space that I came to fill and that I've been doing. But also, a lot of the music, if you listen to it on a layered level, I've always been a political person, but I haven't always been an artist who uses music for politics. purposes. But if you listen deep enough, you can hear some of the activism and some of the things that I'm trying to sneak in, because I know that not everybody is ready to hear it raw. And so I put a little cut on it so they don't even realize that they're singing along to something that's basically saying you should treat all of us equal. You should not be prejudiced. You should not be allowing these things in the way. And you know, they'll next thing they know, you know, they're dancing around, their kids are listening to the song, and grandma's listening to the song, and they're all having a good time, but they're singing about some Black Power stuff. They just don't realize it.
How can we not, at this point, bring up Jessica Krug? I like to bring her up, you know, the African pretendian professor from George Washington, who would pretend to be a Black woman, and she was not a Black woman, and she had this exaggerated, you don't know what I'm talking about?
I just Googled her right now.
She's ridiculous.
She pretended to be a Black woman, but the thing, or a Puerto Rican, pretended to be African American sometimes, or sometimes Puerto Rican. Anyway, she had this exaggerated, like, caricature of Black life. And the thing is that the reason she was able to do this, and the reason why, like, you and I are like, this isn't my life, who the hell is this? Mm-hmm. It's because, you know, I have this whole, Ryan knows, I hate like nonprofit world. I hate freaking grants. I hate them so much because they create this situation where it's like, I need a 2-for-1. I want her to be Black. I want her to be crazy. I want her to be biracial. I want her to be from the Caribbean. So this white woman essentially made up this totally outrageous, I sold crack. I live in the ghetto. But I mean, you're like, oh, why didn't I hear? Because it's like people, they want to get, they take Black culture and make it like this outrageous thing. And then it's like, that was my problem in poetry. They would tell me, well, your parents, your parents aren't beating you. You're not, there's no crack in the story. How do I know it's a Black story? Yes, and this is,
Like we're all living that life. Like, no.
But even if you are living that life,
money, go ahead. I'm sure. Money probably kind of feel. I mean, when you hear Money Mostafi, obviously people are going to ask you, what do you think about Palestine? Yeah. Just like when people see, honestly, like I hear my Jewish friends complain, like I just go to the store with a yarmulke on and people want to ask me about Palestine. You know, like I think we all get pigeonholed and nobody wants to hear what a white guy has to say. We never shut up. So. I don't have this problem. This is why I get to ask these questions, because I just talk and, you know, it's just. But Money, I mean, do you feel like your politics are all, you are very diverse in your politics. You don't just focus on one issue. Your music seems to focus a little bit specifically on, I mean, the name of the band is dedicated to anti-racism. But personally, do you feel the need to, like, tell people, no, I'm more than a Middle East guy. Like, I care about economic issues. I care about, you know, schooling. I mean, you're a father. I mean, you care about what you're getting. I mean, do you feel that pressure as well?
Look, I think anybody who's really gotten into this, you know, we all get niched. And sometimes we all get a sort of put in some sort of lanes, you know. And a lot of times our identities, our upbringings, give us maybe expertise in a certain lane and we flex that expertise. But if you're in this game long enough, if you're thinking about justice and, you know, like true justice, you know, a truly democratic system long enough, there's no way that you don't start diversifying the things you care about and the things you want to work on. You know, so for decades, I was interested in a couple core topics, you know, racism and criminal justice in the US, anti-war, because, you know, way it was targeting people from the Middle East, and like anti-colonial sort of stuff. So that's where I put in my energy. You know, over time, you start seeing climate crisis, you see the way climate crisis is really all about, you know, the poorest, brownest, blackest people at the equator. Like, those are the people that are really gonna suffer. And you can't not say, okay, I got to learn about this. I got to sort of start regearing my activism. It's all, you know, I mean, if anything really teaches you that.
Can't hear.
I got it. If anything's teaching you this stuff's really connected, it's something like the ecosystem. But are you allowed to talk about it if you're, you know, if you have a track record talking about these other things? I kind of hear it. Lark is saying that, you know, there's a fine line between being able to diversify your voice and explore ideas in a diverse way, and sort of, you know, go beyond what might be your comfort zone or what people assume is your comfort zone is also what Lark is saying. And I think that point she made about artistry is really good. Like, the radicalist ideas that I express in song. Why? Because the more out there the idea is, the more you're testing it. You're testing it with yourself, you're testing it with the world. And art allows you a little bit of space, not just to be creative in terms of the way you shape an aesthetic, but in the way you shape a worldview, you know? And sometimes it helps you process that stuff personally. And I like what Jeremy was saying about sort of being a gateway. I think our band in particular, you know, punk rock was started, you know, by Bad Brains. Our hardcore particularly was started by Bad Brains. We were in the hardcore scene, started off as a black music, but like a lot of black music's really, it got, you know, quickly, you know, whitewashed by, you know, suburban kids coming in and sort of trying to own it. And, you know, I should say with the caveat that like the Afropunk movement's really pushed back against that and carved out its own space.
We got to get Daryl Lamont Jenkins to talk about the skinhead movement being co-opted right?
Yeah. I mean, Daryl's been there and he's seen all of it. But
definitely,
you know, when we were in the 90s hardcore scene, it was a really suburban scene. It was really,
I was
really
part of that.
Yeah, it was really it was really heavily white. Like, I think in our scene there was 2 black kids, you know, that would go to shows. 3. There were 3.
New Jersey will know E-Town Concrete shows.
Right. E-Town Concrete maybe had a more diverse
They came out of Elizabeth, so they came, but they still played shows and all
that. Yeah, we played with them. We played with them when we were in Jersey.
Great guys,
But you know, for us, we were sort of trying to talk about, you know, radical racial justice. We were talking about things like systematic racism and white privilege at a time where people just viewed racists as the Nazis and nothing beyond that. You know, they didn't understand. I was listening to what Lark was saying before about how, you know, this sort of eugenics programming in sort of state policy, it's not like the people who are implementing that today are necessarily consciously ideologically pro-eugenics, but it's seeped into so much stuff and into the sort of fabric of policy, right, that they're just repeating the motions. Well, we were talking about stuff like that in the 90s in a mostly white suburban scene. We were either hated or thought we were lunatics or just like some weirdos. But now we see year after year, we planted seeds in all these people's brains. So then something happens and they're like, oh, that's what that band was talking about. Or, you know, we quoted in one of our albums, we quoted KRS-One. We always have a reference to 90s hip hop in all of our records because that influenced us ideologically. Nice. And we quoted KRS-One. And then people went out and got KRS-One and sort of learned what that was all about and what they were saying and helped politicize them in a sort of different way that they were politicized before. So I think one thing that's cool about art is the way you can kind of plant seeds in people's brains, and then, you know, these things show fruition maybe years later. You don't notice it right away. And I don't think you get that in the same other ways of expressing big ideas than you do with art, because art is something that it soaks into the, for lack of a better term, it soaks into the soul in a way. And it soaks into somebody's sense of self. Like, music is so integral to who people are. You know, so many subcultures are defined by their music or the literature or you know, I'm into comic books, I'm into hip hop, I'm into this, that when part of your identity is expressing a new idea, it's hard to avoid it in a way. So that's always kind of been a real rewarding aspect of what we were doing as a band. And I think a lot of artists that try to push new ideas into communities have had similar stories.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get around one more question. So if you guys don't mind, we'll just go a couple minutes late. But I wanted to ask Jeremy, you know, about the positive messaging. I thought about the question, you know, I pre-showed you a little bit on this one, but I wanted to kind of phrase it right. like I said, your music is very positive and it came along at a good time in my life. You know, money just touched on, you know, impacting communities. Well, music impacts me and everybody as an individual. And it really can affect a lot. I mean, we've all gone through like a hard emotional time and listened to a sad song while we ate ice cream in our bed. Right. Yeah. And we've all gone to a party and put on the right tune because we wanted to get everybody off their feet and dancing a little bit. So music has like this tremendous impact. And your music came along at a time when I needed a pick me up. I needed somebody to tell me. And Lark has touched on this in a lot of her writings as well, as part of how she's inspired me, is that we got to stop telling everybody that somehow you need to be poor to be an advocate, that you can't be successful and be, you know, an advocate, that you have to, you know, be, you know, homeless and living penniless. And if you make any money from your activism or from your passions, you need to give it away immediately because, you know, you don't deserve success unless, you know, it's kind of like this communist theory of we want everybody to succeed. But you yourself, you're successful. You said you come from a middle class economic background and you're proud of that. Do you feel like people are kind of critical of, you know, your economic background as well? You didn't really struggle because you didn't have the poor life. Like I came up in the suburbs, but I'm poor now. I mean, does that count? You know,
no. No,
I kind of did it a little backwards. Do you feel that pressure though to not?
No, no, I don't. I mean, I'm a weird cat. Like, I don't really feel pressure because I've not since seventh grade. Because, you know, basically, in my middle school years, I kind of learned to love myself. And once I learned to love myself, other people's expectations don't really add weight to me because they don't control what my brain sees when I think about myself. And so that's really what matters to me. I do understand that some people feel some kind of way about me not having like drug dealer narratives or, you know, talking about despondent or whatever background. Like I've been on reduced lunch. Like, let's not.
Isn't it white people though? Isn't it white people?
Well, of course we're talking about white people. But
it's
like
white people who have the biggest, but I'm saying, but we need to be clear, because I think people will think that you're talking about black people have a problem. White people have a problem with black people who don't have the poor narrative. White people have the hugest problem with that. It's not black people, it's white people. Yeah, I want the audience to be clear with that.
Yes, I agree. And that definitely needs to be made clear, but I'm not going to front like I haven't had issues. And there's some I talk about in some of my songs where I have had some issues with other black people thinking that because of the way that I articulate or because of some of the topics that I talk about, that I'm trying to be white, whatever that is supposed to mean. And so I have had to rail against some of that since high school, whatever, but it never really affected. My parents were my biggest influence on me. And so I knew what they expected of me. So it didn't matter what whoever, whether it was a white classmate or black classmate or whatever, I have the privilege of having come from a two-parent household. And I understand that that's a privilege. And so it makes me be able to explain to some white folks that have different privileges that I didn't have. Like, there are levels to privilege. There's levels to prejudice. There's levels to all of this. And so I've kind of been stuck in the middle a little bit. And that allows me to speak to both worlds. And, you know, I like that weight. I used to, you know, kind of bristle at it. Whatever, but like part of me being positive is that self-love. And so when I'm able to navigate those worlds, deal with the other people's expectations and not take on that additional weight on my own, I'm generally a happy dude. But that's because I've done the work to be, you know, to be loving myself. And so I wanna, you know, give you that hug pre-COVID, you know, and have you feel some of that euphoria from that human connection. Just like I was talking earlier about being on stage, like, you know, I'm looking people in the eye and trying to make that connection so that they can feel that real joy that I have. And some of that's in my music. I'm real about the world and what's going on, but like, I just feel like I do a better job of showing that you can deal with the pressures of racism and capitalism and all that stuff, and it doesn't have to tear you down if you don't let it.
Yeah, I really do. Look, man, I appreciate what that struggle takes. It's not easy to stay positive. And you do. And your music, you know, I want to thank you personally because your music cheered me up, man. It just cheered me up when I was down in the dumps. And I think that's what it's supposed to do, right?
Yeah, I mean.
Thank you. Okay. So it did to a degree, right?
Yeah, I mean.
That's what it did for me.
as Biggie says, you know, fat, black, and ashy. However, like I can be fat and black and whatever you might think from a eugenic standpoint is a negative, because I was listening then too. Well, whatever you might think is a negative, I love to pull from Tio. I love me some me, and there's nothing you can do about it. So you can either have a good time with me or go over there.
There you go. All my comrades are beautiful people. I can tell you that. They're beautiful, beautiful people, and I thank you all. Before we go, I want to make sure you all plug stuff. So, Money, make sure people tell people how to get a hold of this awesome compilation record. And if you got anything else coming up, please take a few minutes. Let us know what's going on with Raised Trader and your world come out.
Yeah, it's 46 songs, some amazing songs, only $10, basically a quarter a song. It's at, you can get it on Bandcamp at shutitdowncomp, like compilation, C-O-M-P, shutitdowncomp@bandcamp.com. All the proceeds, every single dime, except for what PayPal and Bandcamp take, it goes to the Movement for Black Lives. And, you know, we are almost at our goal. We wanted to raise 25K and we're 22. So please, if you want to contribute and get some really, really good, you know, samples of extreme music, extreme underground music, shutitdowncomp@bandcamp.com.
There you go. I can't wait to get that vaccine out. Me and Lark are going to get really drunk jumping one of your mics.
Yeah. We're going to come. We're going to play a show. You're all on the guest list.
Okay. You were talking about having to like trying to do something in Jersey with like a death metal New Jersey Revolution radio thing, and then the apocalypse happened. But we'll get back to that next year sometime, man. I promise you. Jeremy, what you doing? What, how do we find Infinite Skills?
It's real easy. Go to infiniteskills.com. Make sure you put a Z on the end. If you don't put a Z on the end, you might find some kind of basketball team. That's not me. If you want the hip hop, you want the happy, come out with me. But you know, we have songs of struggle. And some sadness in there, too. I think I heard you playing something earlier, but infiniteskills.com. Let's be friends.
It's great stuff, man. I love listening to all of it. I've been listening to it on Spotify as well, and all that stuff. So thank you very much. Lark, I'm going on vacation. I won't be calling you last minute to help me out until October. I promise you.
Okay.
But cool. Before that happens, new websites, Twitter handles, what you got going on, comrade?
Okay. I have a magazine, Political Poetry, Literature, called Public Intellectuals. And because I kind of like just still like, you know, why are only white men get to be public intellectuals? So I took it. It's mine now. Publicintellectuals.org and La Blackest Eye, which is a take on Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. But it's kind of the Spanish whatever. And then that's on Twitter. So Public Intellectuals, Tika. I mean, I'm really easy to Google and find my many various projects.
Yeah. You know, check her out wherever she is and whatever she does. It's great stuff. Leah, our show writer, is here. Hi, Leah. How are you? So I wanted to bring everybody in. You know, I always have to do my last minute money pitch because you can go to www.njrevolutionradio.com and give our big push right now. Regular donations, monthly donations really help us budget out. And because you have helped us with a few extra monthly donations in the past couple of weeks, my continuous ranting and raving is starting to work. But also because of our sponsors like the August Agency and Great Joy Counseling and the Coffee House in Edison and Blissful Infusions and all the others that have, you know, helped us out with events in the past. We're starting to get into more stuff sponsoring the online forums. Because of all that, we gave Leah a raise, and I'm really happy that we're giving her $15 an hour at least for her services, which is something, you know, we should take seriously, right? Hey, I opened up the show by complaining about people that don't treat labor right. And one of the things we're doing here at New Jersey Revolution Radio is we live our values. And Leah's services have been great. They go beyond just writing for this show. And we want her to know that she's appreciated. And you can make sure that you show her appreciation by donating. www.njrevolutionradio.com. You can give us money on Cash App, PayPal, the Action Network thing, whatever. You walk a check over to my house. You can give us some weed. All right. But it's cool. However you want to give, you can give. And it's important that you do because we're trying to live our values and pay labor a decent amount of money. So That's that for this week. Like I said, I'll see you Saturday at 10 a.m. with Dr. Letitia Sampson, so we can talk about mental health and activism with an expert, not a white guy who's pretending to be an intellectual. An actual PhD doctor, licensed clinical social worker, is going to teach us about mental health. So I'm really excited about that. And then we'll be back in October with more art and activism from New Jersey. Until then, this is Brian Powers, and I want to remind everybody that the police can quit their jobs. I'll see you soon, everybody.
Please quit.
Right now.
There you go.
Just say no.
<laughs> 2020 is pulling everyone's mask off. I mean, whether it's Democrats and their murder of the Me Too movement and their blind support for someone like Joe Biden.
They seemed really unreasonable, and it's like, are we still playing this game? What do you guys think about that?
In the here and now, that is going to be my concern. We don't want to see any more loss of life just because the loss of home.
And then have these politicians who want to co-opt everything just because it's near election time.
But solutions for these problems have to be positive, and they can't be based in policing. They just can't be based in more authoritarianism. They don't arrest your way out of these problems.